Welcome to Entrepreneurial Insights, a podcast brought to you by the Society of Entrepreneurs and hosted by Pearson Crutcher and Jay Healy. The Society of Entrepreneurs is a membership organization founded to promote entrepreneurship and provide education and resources to Memphis business owners.
In this podcast, we'll have a series of interviews with accomplished business owners and entrepreneurs in Memphis, Tennessee. There are so many great entrepreneurs in Memphis, and their stories need to be told.
Welcome to Entrepreneurial Insights. Welcome to Entrepreneurial Insights. If you like fast cars, you'll like this podcast. Today's interview is with Ron Coleman from Edelbrock Group, which encompasses such companies as Driven Racing Oil and Competition Cams. If you've ever seen a NASCAR race, you've seen the fruits of Ron Coleman's labor. Enjoy the show. Welcome to Entrepreneurial Insights. I'm so excited today to have a conversation with Ron Coleman. Ron is on the board of Edelbrock Group. We were discussing before the interview started what his title is and what he does, and all I know is that he has lots of companies that have to do with fast cars. So this will be a fun discussion today. Thank you so much for being with us today, Ron.
Glad to do it.
Yeah. So, Ron, it'd be great to hear your background, just what the company history was, how you got started.
I graduated from University of Memphis, and I went to Tulane's law school. I came back here and was practicing law, and I did a lot of work with businesses that were either splitting up or growing, you know, sometimes on a friendly basis, sometimes on an unfriendly basis. And a group hired me to work with them in a lawsuit over a cam company. And so after the lawsuit ended, I got them the rights to compete with the other company. So they wanted to compete. And they wanted me to be a part of it. And I said, no. I said, you don't need me. I wouldn't serve any useful purpose. And they asked me again, and they asked me again. And eventually, we found a reason why I could actually be productive and help them. And I said, okay, well, then I'll do that. Mm-hmm. And over the years, they eventually decided they wanted me to be president. So I became the president, and that was many, many years ago. And we grew Competition Cams from the smallest cam company in the world. We had three employees. You know, you could answer the phone, grind the cam, and do everything and ship it all right there. You know, there wasn't much there.
For those that aren't familiar, what is a cam company?
Thank you.
Well, a cam is the most important part of your engine, of your, you know, like a V8 or 6, it doesn't really matter. The cam is the thing that kind of sets the tone of the engine. It tells it what to do. It helps bring in the fuel and the air and then relieve the exhaust by opening and closing the valves. So it's sort of specialized, and, you know, what we did was a lot of racing. Didn't matter what kind of racing, oval track racing like NASCAR or drag racing like NHRA. But there's street performance. And we did a lot of stuff in like the agricultural field. Believe it or not, a guy who has a farm and he has a couple of bales of hay in the pickup truck and he wants to haul a farm implement from one field to another, you know, a lot of the pickups don't have the power to do it, so they would put a cam in to give it that low-end power. It's been interesting. And, you know, we bought a company that called TCI that had transmissions and torque converters, again, for heavy-duty type stuff, racing and things like that.
So you became president.
I became president and operated the company. And as each individual got to the stage they wanted to get out of it, we bought them out.
Mm-hmm.
And what we have left is my partner, Scooter Brothers, and myself. We're the only original people left. It's kind of interesting. As I was leaving, I ran into a guy who wanted to show me a picture of his daughter. And I said, I didn't know you had a daughter this old. And he said, well, when I first started working for you, I didn't. So we have a lot of people who've worked for us quite a long time.
Mm-hmm.
So what other companies do you have under the umbrella now of Edelbrock?
Well, there's FAST, which is a air fuel spark technology. We have a company that is, you know, sells tools, some kind of specialized tools for, you know, racers and people who work on engines. We have manifolds, we have superchargers, we have blocks, heads. So we have almost, you can probably make an entire engine with just what we have. We actually sell completed engines too, for that matter. So I also, when we combined Edelbrock and Comp together, I did split out Driven Racing Oil, which is a company that makes high-end lubrication for any kind of application. And that's something, I, as I said, I bought from Joe Gibbs.
So all of these companies have to do with race cars. Did you grow up loving cars, or was it just a happy accident that you ended up in this career?
I never really was into racing. I never got into the racing part of it. And that's one of the reasons I was reluctant to get involved in this company to start with. I said, hey, I've never bought a camshaft. I don't even know anybody who has ever bought a camshaft. But we were successful, and we did a lot of things that other people didn't do. We used harmonics for the first time harmonics were used. And harmonics are the vibration in the valve train, and that's what breaks parts and causes problems. At one time, they thought like a V8, a pushrod V8, couldn't go 10,000 RPMs. It turns out they go 10,000 RPMs now, but only because we've made advances in the parts and we've done things for the springs and we've made the rocker arm stronger. And, you know, it's a number of things that you do. Really, with the kind of work we have, nobody really cares how long it lasts as much as how fast it will go. Now, obviously, if you're running a 500-mile race, it has to last at least 500 miles. But for the most part, we just move the weak link. If we make a better spring, then we'll start breaking something else. And we make that better, then we start breaking something else. And it's a never-ending process. There's never enough. Nobody in racing has ever said, well, we've got all the horsepower we want.
I bet not.
So you said that you took over the firm. It was only three employees? Or?
Well, by the time I became the president, there was probably 25.
Okay. And what did it grow to over time?
We had probably 180 people. Mm-hmm. And now with Edelbrock, we have probably as many as 800, 1,200 range.
And multiple manufacturing places?
We do now. I continued to buy, for example, I bought the TCI, which was in Ashland, Mississippi, which is only about 35, 40 miles from here. Mm-hmm. And we left that there. I bought a place that makes parts up in Michigan. Mm-hmm. Edelbrock had a place that manufactured carburetors in North Carolina, Sanford, North Carolina. And they originally started in California, in Torrance, California. And that's where they really did all their manufacturing until we merged. And we've now moved most of that here to Memphis and mm-hmm. Olive Branch area.
Great. What would you say is one of the biggest impacts on the success of the firm over time?
Well, I think it's a combination of things. I think, first of all, we tried to treat people as if they're family. I always resisted having, you know, these big, you know, 200-page books
employee
on the rules.
Manuals.
And, yeah. And, you know, because everyone's is an individual, and there's, you know, some people who try to take advantage of the system, and you have to kind of tell them they can't do it. And then there's occasions when people need to bend a rule, and, mm-hmm. and you try to do that for them. We still have our first employee.
Oh, really?
He's been there over 40 years. Mm-hmm. I don't know how long he'll last, much, much longer, but he's there. And we have a lot of people who've been there a long, long time.
Yeah, yeah. So you said a few things, so.
Well, and, I think you have to be financially successful, because without that, you really can't pay the people what they deserve. And I think you have to have somewhat of a view toward the future who you hire. We hired a man who worked in our tech department, and I told my partner, that guy's going to be the premier cam designer in the world. And he is today. He's famous in the cam designing world. Yeah. You know, there's not a lot of cam designers out there. General Motors only has one.
Wow.
So they call us and, you know, we tell them what to do. When they have a problem with a race car, they call us and we say, okay, let's do this, let's do this.
Mm-hmm. Well, I was just thinking about, so are there people that are driving in the NASCAR circuit right now that you would say that y'all are watching and thinking, we did all of that. That's our engine. That's our cam. That's our...
Well, we see that, but you know, racing is a combination of things. You have to have luck. You have to have skill. You have to have other people around you having bad luck or having bad skill. So it's a combination of things. There's no one wins or loses on one part or one engine or one driver. It's a combination of things. And to be successful, you know, you have to have the right combination at the right time.
Well, you've talked about people. So how do you find those people? How do you find your best employees?
What we always did was we looked for people who were enthusiasts. Most of the people who work for me who've been there a long time, their vocation is what they do, but this was their advocation also. So if I didn't send them to a race, they would probably go buy a ticket to go to a race because they wanted to see it. They were interested in it. So finding someone who's enthusiastic about what you want to do, it means something to them. I had a lot of employees who had jobs at larger, big companies, General Motors, Ford, but they don't want to do that. They don't want to spend their whole life designing a rearview mirror. I mean, they want to make a difference and see it on a racetrack or as an enthusiast.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting.
Yeah, that certainly makes a lot of sense.
Did you recruit a lot of people from Memphis over time, or was it more of a national approach?
We take anybody we can find anywhere. You know, it's like finding a gold nugget. They're everywhere. Sometimes you don't recognize them. They're covered with dirt or they're not as shiny as you think they should be. So a lot of the people...
Is Ron talking about me?
We hired people in and we polished them up and they got better and better. And some of them just are exceptional people. And most of the people who've stayed around are those kind of people, exceptional.
Yeah. That's an interesting scenario because I think a lot of great entrepreneurs do that. They elevate people up beyond what they're hired for, but to reach their capabilities, right?
Well, and I think that's one of the things I've always been proudest of. When we started with three people, ended up with up around almost 200. And it's jobs for those people. And they make a living. It supports their wives and their children. And it makes a difference in their lives. I mean, it's really surprising how people, you know, get an opportunity and grow and prosper from it. So there's a lot of people I'm real proud of what they've accomplished. And I'm proud that I've been able to provide the means by which they can accomplish what they've done.
Do you have a particular example of when you elevated somebody up to, you know, roles and responsibilities that maybe nobody else thought was reasonable or feasible?
There's a bunch of examples. I mean, my cam designer was almost with his PhD in nuclear physics.
Uh-huh.
And so I decided that I thought using, everyone designs cams based on engineering. They're generally, it's a mechanical engineer who does it. And I looked at it and I discovered that physics is really mechanical engineering when it comes to cams. And because of that, I think he had a unique edge and view. And, you know, as he came up, I mean, he blew up engines by mistake. He did. I mean, he made some mistakes, don't misunderstand me. But he prospered, and I'm real proud of him. He's done a great job. He's raised a family with that and is very highly and well-respected.
Well, your cam designer made mistakes, but he learned from those mistakes. Are there any things mistakes you made along the way that you learned great lessons from?
You know, Pearson, I try not to make any mistakes.
Of course not.
If I make them, I try not to admit them. There's a number of mistakes that we've made. You know, not every one of our products have been successful. And, you know, we've gotten down, our new product design has been pretty simple. I tell people, is there a problem? And what problem does this new part solve? If it doesn't solve a problem, we have a terrible time trying to sell it.
Sure.
If you find me a problem that everyone says, we've got this problem, and I can design a part that solves that problem, I have no trouble at all selling the part. So what we've learned is don't, you know, fix things that aren't broken. Maybe that's one of the most important lessons we've learned. But, you know, sometimes you swing and you miss. You know, that's the way life is.
Right. We learn our best lessons that way frequently.
That's right. And I'm sure I've made many, many mistakes. And, you know, I think if you just make a few more good things, you know, right decisions, it makes up for a lot of wrong decisions.
So what would you say was the best decision you made?
You know, what you're asking me is kind of like it's reversed the other question. I've made a lot of good decisions. And I remember all, no.
They're all tied for first place.
That's right, exactly.
Well, I mean, you know, I think it's probably in the way we treat and bring people along. If you come in and, I mean, when we had this merger, the guys who were running the company were people who started off in the tech office, which is is where you start. You know, that's where you start learning. I mean, they were running the company, so they came from the lowest position to the highest position. And it's not just one or two, it's a bunch of them like that. I mean, they've become the pinnacle. They're engine builder, technical advisors, they're CEOs, they're those kinds of things that they've developed into. They started off a lot lower. And a lot of the people, of course, started off, you know, thinking they were going to be a race car driver and ended up, you know, contributing more to racing in a lot of ways by working with the CAM company and with Edelbrock and those.
That's really cool. Well, you said you didn't grow up in the racing industry. So did you have any special mentors or advisors that you worked with to help you kind of understand the whole world?
Yes. You know, when we started, we had six people who formed this company. And interestingly enough, each one of them played an exceptionally special role. What I found is that at any given time, one of them's traits would be really better than everybody else's. And so it was sort of a blend, a good mix. And, you know, I still rely very heavily on my partner, Scooter. You know, he knows a lot of stuff that I don't know. And I get information and am able to use that advice, consent from those kinds of people. The people we have working for us are generally as smart as or smarter than me. And so I listen to them and I try to incorporate their changes, their suggestions, their ideas into what we do.
Very interesting. So what was the best piece of advice you've ever been given as you've been growing and building the business?
That's another tough question. You know, I'm not sure advice. I think I had an advantage, and maybe an unfair advantage. When I practiced law for all those years, I saw all sorts of mistakes that went wrong. They were in lawsuits or about to be in lawsuits, heavy disputes. And if you watch, you can learn, I don't ever want to do that. And, you know, they were negative influences. I knew a boy that went to school with me, high school with me, a year in back of me. His father died. He inherited a lot of money and made every possible mistake he could as to how to invest it.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, our law firm was involved, and we kept telling him, don't do this, don't do that. And you can only help people so much, but seeing other people's mistakes and learning has been important to my development and my success, because you can see somebody else has made this mistake. You don't have to make it.
Mm-hmm. That's a unique perspective. And I think that experience as a lawyer gives you a wide angle on other people's mistakes.
You know, the other thing I always thought that was real important, and I've said this before, is, you know, I used to throw newspapers. When I was in high school, I threw the commercial appeal.
Mm-hmm.
And at that time, you know, you had to get up every morning about 4:35 o'clock to get your papers. You had to deliver every paper on the porch, and nobody cared whether it was Christmas Day or New Year's Eve or, you know, the day after. I mean, every day we had to do it. And then we had to go around and collect money. You know, you couldn't have it mailed in like they do today. So I had to go around and collect money. And you learn a lot about people by interacting with them and doing business with them. And to me, that was a big help. That was a big help. And, you know, I've worked in a lot of different areas. You know, I started working when I was in high school, and I've not been without work to today. You know, I tell my children this. They, you know, they've had periods where they didn't have jobs. I've always had a job. And I never really worked for anybody else. And the people say, what do you mean? I took the responsibility for every job I had, whether I was working for you, I was going to do the absolute best job I could, or whether I was working for one of my businesses, I was going to do a good job. So I always say that I work for myself. I didn't work for the commercial appeal. I work for myself delivering papers. I work for myself and doing these things.
I like that a lot.
Yeah. Did you always think you would own a business at some point?
I have been involved in businesses since about the third or fourth grade.
Mm-hmm. What was that?
In the cereal box, there was a deal where if you finished the cereal and sent 25 cents in, you could get 500 tattoos. And they were the kind you licked and put on. And so I did that. And I was selling tattoos to my classmates. And it got to be so good that the nun said, "What's going on here?" I said, "Well, you know, nothing." And she said, "No, why do you have all these quarters and all this?" So I ended up having to contribute that to the foreign mission. So I'm responsible for converting a lot of people in other lands.
So did you buy them and then see that opportunity? And also, were you doing the actual tattoos? I mean, are you that multi-talented?
Well, I didn't do the tattoos, but I did cut them out and sell them.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. That's pretty funny.
But I've probably been in 50 different businesses. I am a serial entrepreneur. You know, a lot of the things have failed, and there have been some that have been successful.
If somebody came to you and said, "You know what, Ron, I'm thinking about starting a business," what would be the thing that you would tell them?
I think you have to have a good idea. And then I think you have to have, a good idea is kind of the foundation of a business. If you got a really bad idea, I tell people, don't do that. And, you know, sometimes people convince themselves their idea is good, even though it's pretty obvious to most people it's not a good idea. So having a good idea, and then I think figuring a way to uniquely bring that particular product to where you want it to be. I've seen a lot of products that I thought were great. There's a couple of patents that I've tried to get the license on for a period of time, and I tried to make them successful. There's a patent for a manifold that's, I think, brilliant. The trouble is we've never been able to make it work. In theory, it works all the time, but in practice, we couldn't make it work. So a good idea is part of it, but it also has to be something you can uniquely make into a product that people can afford and that solves a problem for those people.
That's good advice.
Execution. Really,
yes, for sure.
Right.
You've had to learn so many different things because you are in a business that you had to learn everything about. How do you stay current with what's going on in the world to continue to learn?
Well, you know, I'm a big believer in the Wall Street Journal every day.
Mm-hmm.
I'm also a big believer in being involved in whatever industry you're in. And, you know, I got involved in the industry, became, you know, on the board and the chairman of the board of our trade organization. And it gives you a different perspective and you learn a broader range of things because in the automotive aftermarket, in the performance automotive aftermarket, there's a number of, you know, different kinds of businesses, tires, wheels, things for Jeeps. You know, there's all sorts of things. And you learn it's a big, big world and there's a lot of opportunities. I see opportunities everywhere. When I was probably 3 or 4 years out of law school, I made goals for myself. And one of my goals that I've refined is my goal is to help others reach their goal. And so I'm always trying to help people who I think need help and who deserve help, people who are, you know, sincere about what they're trying to do. So I try to mentor everybody I can get my hands on. They don't always take, you know, they don't always take your advice, but you offer it and you try to get people to go in the right direction. And it's tough. I also think it's important that you be honest. And I tell people that we try to live by not only the letter of the contract, but the spirit of the contract. I had a dealing with a federal mogul. I bought a business and they came to me and said, "Yeah, you owe us this money." And I said, "Why do I owe you this money?" And they explained to me, and I said, "Well, the contract doesn't exactly say that, but that's kind of what we were trying to do. That's what we agreed to. And so I'll send you a check." And the guy said, "What?" I said, "I'll send you a check." He said, "You're going to send me a check?" I said, "Yeah, I'll send you. I owe you the money. I'm going to send you a check." And he was amazed that anyone would treat him fairly, which is a shame.
That is a shame.
Because, you know, it does come back to you because people know about it and they try to deal with people they think are going to treat them fairly.
Mm. Very true. Well, what do you see for the company in the next 5 to 10 years?
The automotive industry is going through a big revolution. There's no possible way for all of us to be driving electric cars, even though if you watch the Super Bowl, you'd think all the commercials are about electric cars. They can't make enough electric cars. And if they did make enough electric cars, they can't power them and they can't keep them up. There's going to have to be a breakthrough in storage, battery storage, and in how to recharge the batteries. And when that happens, I think we'll see a lot more electric cars. Currently, though, the cars that we drive are actually fairly good. The first couple of minutes until the catalytic converter heats up is where most of the pollution is. After it heats up, very little pollution comes out anymore. So it's in transition, and I know people now who are trying to figure out how to sell parts to electric cars. You know, the oil company that I have, you know, they still have to have lubrication. You know, they don't have lubrication the same way that V8 has lubrication, but they have to have lubrication. So we'll adopt different techniques and different products to make that better. You know, I always used to tell people at the CAM company, if you can buy it from General Motors, we don't make it. If we can't make it unique, better, and different from General Motors, then you don't need to come to us. You know, you can't buy anything as cheap as you can when they're making millions of them. I mean, you can buy a camshaft a lot cheaper than our camshafts. They won't do the same thing. But the other thing is you got to realize every gasoline-driven engine, nobody comes up and says, I don't have a cam. They all have cams. You know, every one of them has a cam. So the question is, you have to make your product where they want it, where it provides them something of worth that they actually are willing to spend the money to get. So I can't make the same thing General Motors makes and make money off of. So we have to make it better, you know, unique, solving a problem.
You're not selling products to somebody like me. I mean, most of your products are for specialized race car, or
Pearson,
not for me
driving my
SUV. Right?
I'd be glad to sell you a product. I'd be glad to.
I don't know where my cam is.
Well, I'm not sure that you'd need one or that you'd see the value in one. But every car out there has a cam and doesn't need a cam. They don't generally wear out that much. But if you want to do something unique with it, then you probably need to change. And it's the single most important performance aspect of your car, the camshaft is.
I think it's a great example of a company focusing on a niche
right.
that is not served by the bigger parts of the industry. But for the people who want it, you can definitely provide some real value.
And proof in that is when Ford or General Motors has a problem with their race car,
mm-hmm.
they come to us to say, how do you fix this? We fixed a problem with General Motors, and they sent a team of like 6 people down to ask, how did you do this? And we said, well, you know, how we did it is what we sell. You
right,
know?
Right.
And we improved their performance considerably.
Okay. I have a very important question.
I want to hear it.
Ford versus Ferrari, was it an accurate movie?
I was a friend of Carroll Shelby.
Oh.
Carroll Shelby and I are in a Hall of Fame, the automotive,
really?
The SEMA Hall of Fame.
Wow.
Yeah.
And so I would see him, I would hang out with him on occasions, and he's a really unique individual. And he's most racers have a few tricks up their sleeve.
Uh-huh.
They don't tell you everything. You know, there's always a few things. And parts of the movie, his current widow, Cleo, told me she didn't like the movie. But I think it was fairly accurate.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, they embellished certain parts and
sure.
all that, but
sure.
yeah, it was fairly accurate. I mean, when an American tries to beat a bunch of Europeans, it's always a fight, and it's, you know, there's a lot of gamesmanship involved.
Sure. Yeah, that's fascinating. And the fact that you know Shelby is remarkable. Yeah.
He's come to Memphis at least 2 or 3 occasions. And
did he use your cams?
Yes, and, you know, he... he basically redoes Mustangs for the most part. And when they redo them, depending upon the type and what they're trying to do with it, we'll sell parts to them and they'll put them in. Jack Roush does the same thing, and he uses the parts too. But, you know, it's kind of a trade-off. What part do you need and what you're trying to accomplish and what do you, how many horsepower do you want to get? And
right.
So we try to fix it up that way.
Cool.
That is cool. Have you ever driven a race car?
I have driven many race cars, and I think we've well established.
Daphne Large would be so
jealous.
Yeah,
exactly.
It's a good thing that I'm not a race car driver. I was in Las Vegas, and they have a track out there, and they have all the exotic cars. And so there was a Ferrari, so I got in this red Ferrari, and they have a guy sitting next to you, and he's trying to help you guide you. And so he said, be real slow coming out. And so he looks, and he says, okay, go on out. I go out on the track, and I hit this first straightaway, and he says, hit it. Boom, I hit it. And that Ferrari took off like you wouldn't believe. And I get to there at the very end of this straightaway is a hairpin turn. And he starts yelling, brake, brake, brake. And, of course, I touched the brake, and it just slows the car down. It was great. And I went around three or four corners before I finally realized he had a brake on his side. He was the guy doing the brake.
Okay.
Oh, wow.
It wasn't me. It was him. But I've driven some exotic cars. I've ridden in a Formula One car, the one that won the Brazil Grand Prix three or four years back. They hollow out a spot for a passenger, and those are interesting cars. Very, you know, they get up and go and can stop on a dime. NASCARs, I've driven NASCARs, and I tell people with a NASCAR, it's really pretty easy. As long as you're the only guy out there, it's easy. The car's great. They stick to the track. They go fast. It's when you get the second car out there that's the problem. And if you get 15 or 20 of them, you're in a real problem.
Yeah, I bet. Oh, I bet.
That's right. Yeah. It's kind of the way I feel on Poplar sometimes.
That's true. That's true.
So do you think that Memphis played a role in the success of the business?
I'm not sure that Memphis did play a role. You know, one of the things that's interesting about Memphis is there's more cam companies in, say, maybe a 20, 30-mile radius of Memphis than there is anywhere in the world that I know of. Hmm. And that's because somebody worked for somebody, and then went off and started a cam company, and somebody worked for that and started it. So there is a lot of knowledge here. And there's a good group of people who are enthusiasts and enjoy that sport.
Mm-hmm.
So, and that always helps because having tracks close by, you know, helps.
Mm-hmm.
There's Riverside Speedway over in West Memphis where they, you know, that's my favorite racing is sprint car racing. It's dirt track sprint car racing. They do all kinds of things you wouldn't believe over there.
Mm-hmm. So with that, when you would invent a new type of cam or the company would develop something, would you have to put it in a car and take it to the racetrack?
Well, I never invented it. Of course, the people who worked for me invented
that.
I'm not that good.
Mm-hmm.
But what we would do is we have an engine dyno, we have a chassis dyno, and we have what's called a spintron. And with all that testing, we pretty well know what the result is going to be long before you ever get to the car. And the higher up in racing you go, the less likely, you know, people think, I'll just send this over there and they'll put it in and run it. They won't do that. Typically, if they have a new part, they'll send it to us and say, test this and tell me if it will work and won't cause a problem.
Mm-hmm.
Because the first thing we look for is, what does it hurt? And then the second thing we look for is, does it make an improvement,
right.
You know, and can we measure that improvement?
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
Wow. Very interesting.
Well, it's the high level of racing, you know, it's like going to the Olympics. It's the little bit, it's the hundredth of a second that you beat somebody by not, you don't beat somebody by 3 seconds, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So we're talking about Memphis a little bit.
Well, you know, Memphis has been good, and I think it's good because it is fairly entrepreneurial. I mean, there's a lot of people out there who are interested and who want to help people if you know, want to be helped. And we didn't need the help because we were lucky enough to have the right mix of people at the right time. You know, at any given time, we had an engineer who, you know, designed cams. At any given time, we had a salesman who had a knack for selling it. At any given time, you know, we had someone who was good with the books and records to keep up with things. We had a guy who was great with manufacturing. He was a cam grinder. I mean, those people all contributed a great deal to the success. And without them, I don't know where we'd have been, because there's a lot of cam companies around here that have never grown, that they've never gotten to where we luckily have gotten to.
Yeah, interesting.
So you had the right people in the right place, right?
Well, I think that's part of some of it. You know, a lot of it's luck, and a lot of it is not doing everything the same way everybody else does it. When we started studying harmonics, we used to get a ream of paper out of a test. And that ream of paper was like a haystack. And in there, we knew there was a needle, but we didn't know where it was. And it took a long time to figure out where to look for the needles. And that led us to advances that other people didn't do. You know, most of the other cam companies tend to copy stuff rather than, you know, invent it. They tend to copy it. And, copying it's fine. But you're never going to make an advance if you're just copying. We had a NASCAR team that we sent two engineers in a private plane over to them to work on their dyno. We put a cam in, and the cam got more horsepower than the cam they were running. We took that out and put another cam in, and it got even more horsepower. We took that out, and they went to lunch. They came back, and they put the third one in, and it even got a lot more power. And we took that out, and they got back in the plane and flew home. And 2 or 3 days later, the team calls and says, hey, those cams, they were great. We want to buy some of those. And we said, well, you know, what we were trying to show you was we've been selling you one cam a year, and you've been copying it. And we've made three generations of cams that are better. And so because you're copying it, you're copying the old stuff, not the new stuff. And we can't afford to let you, to sell you our best cam, have you copy it, and because I got to pay all these engineers. I had 18 engineers I got to pay. I got a lot of mouths to feed. And so if you want our product, we don't mind selling it to you, but we want to sell it on a regular basis. We don't want you copying it.
Well, that certainly makes a lot of sense, yes. But I guess that's flattery, right?
Well, it is interesting that we were able to do that. But they, I mean, at that level, they can't afford to leave a lot of horsepower on the table or they're going to lose.
Right.
And it depends on, you know, what you're more interested in, saving money or winning. And winning comes with it extra money, so most of them want to win.
I can see that. You mentioned that Memphis is entrepreneurial, and so I just kind of want to go back to Memphis as an overall topic to say, why do you think Memphis is an entrepreneurial city?
I'm not sure I know. There's a lot of good ideas that have come out of here. If you think about it, you know, Clarence Saunders, Kemmons Wilson, Wallace Johnson, there's been a number of people who ever thought Holiday Inns would be what it was. I mean, when they first started, probably a lot of people thought it was a bad idea. And look how successful, you know, people don't realize they're the first ones to have a national call-in line where you can get a reservation. They did all the stuff that now we think of as commonplace.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So there's a history, and I think a history of being entrepreneurial and successful helps other people. I mean, I see it a lot. I see a lot of people get help right now. I try to, you know, help various ones. Mainly they need money or they need advice or they need both. And you try to help them, you know, move forward. There's a lot of good ideas out there. And as the world changes, the market kind of changes. And you have to be able to try to look out ahead of everybody else to see what's out there. That's one of the reasons why I think we have people who have been successful at seeing farther out what's coming rather than what's here. Because if you're only dealing with what's here, you're going to miss what's coming.
Were you born and raised in Memphis?
I was born in Memphis and moved to New York City.
Really?
When I was a kid, I moved from there to Dallas, Texas, then Corpus Christi, Texas, San Antonio, Texas. And I came back here for my sophomore year of high school, went to Christian Brothers.
Oh.
Then I went down to New Orleans for my legal degree. And then I tried to find jobs in Dallas and Houston and Atlanta and, you know, Nashville and Memphis. And I ended up with 3 job offers in Memphis before Easter of my senior year. So I thought, well, I guess I'm coming to Memphis.
Well, we're glad you did that. Yeah. For sure. Certainly glad that you're in Memphis.
What excites you about Memphis these days?
Well, I see the beginnings of kind of a Nashville type place. You know, Nashville is growing like a weed. And I knew Nashville back when it was pretty pitiful. And when you go there now, it's like incredibly different. And I see the seeds of that happening downtown and in other places of Memphis. You know, we have different problems that are going to be harder to overcome than Nashville. I mean, you know, they have a seat of government which employs a lot of people with a lot more money. You know, the average income is higher there. And there's a lot of those government jobs are high paying. And it attracts more, you know, college educated people. But, you know, our challenge here is in getting our young people educated, you know, because education is the key to their future. And most of the kids don't realize that when they're younger.
Yeah,
they have to,
right.
You know, that has to be drummed into them. You know, what they need is the tools that will enable them to do whatever they want. Interestingly enough, you don't have to go to college. You don't have to get a PhD or a master's degree. I don't know if you've had try to have your car worked on. I needed something fixed on my trunk of my car, and it's 30-day wait before I can get in because they're so packed with people. So there's a lot of great jobs that are tech-type jobs. You don't have to get a college degree. You just have to get an education. You have to learn how to plumb, or you have to learn how to electricity, air conditioning, heating. You know, there's all sorts of trades that you can do, and you can make great money.
Mm-hmm.
Especially on the horizon with the Blue Oval, the Ford plant that they're putting in East Tennessee. I mean, in West Tennessee. What do you think about that?
Well, I think it's a great thing for this area. I wish it was a little closer, but it's going to cause the Memphis group to kind of build out in that direction past some of the already established areas, Lakeland and so forth. But I think it'll be a big boom, and a lot of people will probably live here and go in. That area right there has got a lot of potential, and it's an area that, you know, I sit on some committees for the Chamber of Commerce, and we were worried about it. You know, the argument was, do you put the infrastructure in, spend the state's money to put infrastructure in, and then try to attract somebody, or do you try to attract somebody and then put the infrastructure in? And I think we were sort of in the middle of starting to put infrastructure in when we found Ford. So I think it's a great thing. I think it's going to be a big boom for the community. I think it'll help. It'll raise the, you know, the salaries and incomes of the people, and it'll attract a lot of people.
So you mentioned your involvement with the Memphis Chamber, but you're also on other boards and involved with other organizations that are giving back to the community. You want to elaborate on that?
Well, you know, I think that if you live in a community, one of the things you have to do is sort of give back to the community. You have to try to make the community better than when you found it, in every way you can. So I've sat on a number of boards. I've been chairman of most of the boards and done a little bit of everything. And I kind of keep moving around. You know, the challenges, people don't realize some of the challenges. I mean, I'm on the board of Regional One Hospital right now. Very challenging situation. We collect, you know, 14, 15 cents on every dollar we bill. I believe fundamentally that everybody who's sick should be cared for. I mean, if you're injured, you should be cared for. I don't think we should just let people go because they can't pay. And that's sort of the mission and the problem with, you know, Regional One has. And they've got a fantastic burn center. They've got a fantastic trauma center. They've got a brand new cancer center that's a big help. But it's the kind of thing that it's hard to figure, you know, how much skin are you going to need for the burn unit? You don't know. You don't know who's coming. You don't know what they're going to need or anything else. And so it's a tough one. It's no way to make it a profitable operation. You just have to hope the subsidies that you get from the cities and states and federal government help you to make ends meet. And they do a great job down there.
Yeah.
They certainly do.
They definitely fill a role that otherwise wouldn't be filled.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I have a very important question that we ask every single podcast. Do you think that entrepreneurs are born or taught?
I think they're born. I think a person either is born with a risk tolerance or they don't have the risk tolerance. And those that don't have a risk tolerance are never going to go out and gamble, you know, because when you start a business, it's a gamble. You can lose just as easily as you can win. Matter of fact, in some ways, it's easier to lose than it is to win. So I think I'm not sure that you might be able to train somebody, but I don't know that you can train that risk taker in them. I've always been a risk taker. I've been in a whole lot of businesses. And you take your chance and you fail sometimes and you go to the next problem. You know, you learn, as you said earlier, from your mistakes. So I believe, and I also believe that children, when they're born, are kind of the way they are. I don't think their parents change them much. The personality is sort of built into them. And each one of them is different. They can be born to the same parents, go through the same schools, be taught the same things, and they'll be different. I look at my three kids. You know, they're completely different. I've got one who will never take a risk. I'm sure he'll never be in his own business. I've got another one who I wish she wouldn't take so many risks. You know, I mean, calm down a little bit. You know, don't take so many risks. So I think it's born, it's innate when a person's born, a lot of the things that they're going to carry through their entire life.
That's well said.
I agree. Well, you know, I know, having known you for a while, that you love your job, that you love what you do. But what do you do for fun? It seems like you're always working.
Well, you remind me of one of the first attorneys I worked for, and I asked him, what does he do for a hobby? And he says, I work for a hobby. And the truth is, that's what I do. I enjoy being involved in a business in some way. That's mainly what I do. Now, you know, I've done other things, but I go to the office every day, and I don't have the same responsibilities because I was fortunate enough to develop people who truly make better decisions than I make. I'm not sure I should say this, but, you know, people say, well, don't you have a hobby? And I say, I always tell people as a joke now that all my hobbies and things like that are either illegal or immoral, so I can't do them. So that's why I work.
Well, there you go. Ron, thank you so much for being here. This has been so much fun. I really, really appreciate it. So you've got more energy than most people that I know. So,
well, it's a pleasure to be here. I'm not sure that you got the best of the entrepreneurs. The society has a lot of people that are much, much better than me. But I'm grateful that you asked me.
Absolutely. It's been great. Good conversation. Thank you, Ron.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to Entrepreneurial Insights. If you want to hear more about Ron Coleman, his experience, you can look in our show notes.